to go do some drumming, to go to a drum, kind of an informal drum class. There's a young man in Bellingham. He moved here from New England, who's quite a wonderful, he's a white fellow, about 35, and he's quite a skillful practitioner of West African drumming, music from Ghana and Senegal and a little bit Mali. And when he first came to town a couple of years ago, he was really actively trying to sort of create classes and, you know, try to find a way that he could teach drumming for a living and, you know, charge a little bit of money and so on and do posters. And I helped him with the website and was trying to encourage him because he's really not only a really skilled drummer, but very good at breaking it down and explaining the music and presenting a very sort of step-by-step path forward, and at the same time really holding the line, like really, you know, expecting and you know, just very naturally and gently expecting that the music will be very good and very precise and very well done. And he calls his little outfit Doni Doni Drums, and I guess that means little by little drums. So he was trying to do this, but it really wasn't going that well from the point of view of attracting lots of students and getting enough money. And so he took a day job at Trader Joe's, along with 120 other people in our community, it turns out. Did you know that? Trader Joe's has created 120 jobs, so go buy more cookies. And anyway, not a bad job. And I know quite a few people who work at Trader Joe's, and every one of them says, God, I never thought in my life I'd work at a grocery store. It's like the weirdest thing, but it's actually like a really good job. So they all say that, yeah. So maybe they don't all feel that way, but all 120, but the five that I know do. And so anyway, and then Keith, it turns out, my drumming teacher friend, has some other interests too. He's also quite a skilled bird watcher. I guess he didn't go to graduate school, so he's not an ornithologist, but he's a very good bird watcher, and so he also got a little bit of work doing field surveys of birds, and you know that the drumming wasn't really going that great, so he stopped for a little while, and so then I haven't been playing drums for about 6 or 8 months, and I've been meaning to mention it in Dharma Talk because it's really been a wonderful practice for me on a lot of levels. One is that I'm a beginner, like I really am a beginner. You know, like we go around the Zen places, all the experienced students are always saying, oh yeah, I'm really a beginner, you know, but you kind of know, you know. It's true, it is actually true, but it's kind of not true in a certain way too, right? And so when I'm trying to learn a new rhythm in drum class with Keith and I'm getting it wrong and he's stopping me and he's correcting me and he's telling me, oh, only do half of it, it's like pretty difficult, you know? I'm like not doing it right, you know? And there's a part of my mind that's telling me, you can't do this. There's a part of my mind that tells me very insistently, you can't do this, you're not getting it right, it's slipping past you, you're trying too hard, you know, relax, you know? You're telling yourself, relax, you know? And everyone's playing, you're like, trying to do it right. And but then, oddly enough, after going through that many times with different rhythms that he's introduced to us, after a while, somehow you do relax, and somehow you are playing it in the right way, you know, more or less. You have to still, you know, you can't sort of just sort of space out and, oh, I got it, you know, and then you do it wrong again. But you have to be very steady with your attention. But having this experience, this arc of like, I'm a dummy, I don't know what I'm doing, all those things, to like, wow, you know. And the learning is sort of not that kind of learning of, like, I figured it out. More is like, there's a part of my mind that figured it out, and there's a part of my mind that just got the hell out of the way, finally, mm-hmm. to allow the potential of my body and my mind and my heart to just come forth, like, sort of, you know, sort of naturally and sort of with effort, you know. So it's an interesting kind of effort and a kind of working with that mind that says you don't know what you're doing. So I've been meaning to mention that for a while, but then kind of drumming fell away, you know, and all the different students, there were 4 or 5 of us that were going pretty regularly, but without Keith to sort of call us up, and he's a pretty informal guy too, he doesn't like send letters or emails, he calls each one of us, you know, you want to go drumming tonight, you know, even if it's a regular night, he calls everybody, you know, I'm like, yeah, Keith, it's a regular night, I'm coming, you know, or, oh, sorry, I can't make it next week, you know. But Keith stopped doing that, and we all stopped, every one of us to a person stopped playing pretty much, you know, and stopped seeing each other. So somehow this little community just sort of fell away, and we all have other stuff to do. It's not like anybody missed it that much, you know, like, well, I got my Monday nights back. I, you know, taught a mindfulness class instead, you know. More time with my family. I got to watch a little more, you know, TV, relax a little more. You know? These are good things, you know, these are good things. And so it's not like we were, the five or eight of us were going around town just bemoaning our fate and asking Keith constantly, when are we going to start again? You know, we just kind of let it go. So a couple of weeks ago, he called us up again. And last night I went, and instead of renting a place as he had been, it was in the basement of his very modest little two-bedroom house on Sunset, sort of first home for he himself and his wife. And he was very happy about this little house. To my eyes, it looked a little dingy, you know, but he was very happy, so I tried to appreciate that. Very small. We went into his basement, and there were five of us, or six of us. And even though we had not played together in 6 months, somehow it really was wonderful. We were really, you know, we had stuff to learn, and he had to stop us, and we had to figure out our parts and relearn some things. But somehow we were really playing, and it really was a wonderful feeling, a real feeling of connection. And it was more casual, too, being in his house. So then after drumming for 2 hours, which was the agreement he had with his neighbors, he wisely talked to his neighbors ahead, said he would stop at 8, so we did stop at 8. Then we went into his kitchen, little teeny kitchen, 5-6 of us, a little teeny kitchen, and we drank beer, and we were hanging out and talking. And then I got up, and he said that he had broken his ski bindings. He went skiing, and his bindings broke. And I thought, oh, this is a perfect excuse to give him some money. You know, because he hadn't, like, said, this is a class, you need to pay. You know, it's like, he didn't say, there was no business arrangements. He just called us up. We went to his house, you know. We're having a wonderful time. And yet he clearly was the center of this group and was teaching us and had written parts out on his little whiteboard and had stopped us and simplified the rhythm when we couldn't get, you know, there's one part we couldn't figure out. And so I whipped, he said about his ski bindings, you know, so I whipped out a $10 bill and I was handing it to him. Oh, we all want to help you with your ski bindings. And he said, no. You're like my family now. And I could not play the drums without you. Which is true because it's an ensemble form of music. He can't be the lead djembe player without me playing the big dun-dun drum, which is big deep drum, with the ballant up, without Aaron playing the medium-sized drum called the songbon, without Jen playing the little drum called the kinkini, without two other people playing lower-pitched djembes as support parts. So without us, he actually couldn't actualize his talent. He couldn't actually be completely a good drummer without us basic, you know, more or less beginners. You know, maybe now we're intermediate beginners, maybe. You know, compared to sort of master drummers in West Africa, we're definitely like, you know, 8-year-olds, maybe, you know. And he's shown us videos of, like, it's a family affair, right? So there's a drumming family in the village, and so everyone plays in that family, including the little kids. Pretty male-oriented, I guess, though. Little boys play. So I was quite touched by that, you know, and I thought, well, isn't that interesting how much we need each other? And then I was thinking about that when I came in tonight, once the sitting started, and I saw, like, oh, not very many people. The thought arose in my mind. Did that thought arise in your mind? Like, oh, not very many people. Where are all the other people? You know? And then a feeling of, like, desire arose. Like, I want more people to be here. I noticed that desire. And I noticed it seemed to be sort of linked to that desire, some doubt. I noticed some doubt arising. Like, well, maybe. And we had just had a not horribly cheerful board meeting, actually, where we're looking at how few people have renewed their membership, and how, you know, we'd hurt people, you know, all those kind of things. Once you're administering anything, you can find a lot of things to worry about, right? So we were worrying about those things together. And, you know, not terribly depressed. We weren't giving up the hope, and we were, you know, making plans and moving forward and all that, but a bit of a feeling of, like, doubt. You know, there's a little bit of doubt in the air. And so then I'm thinking, like, with the five hindrances, right? Doubt is like the sort of kingpin on top of the system. Doubt is up there. And then doubt is supported by two pairs of dancing partners. Doubt's like the disco ball or the chandelier, maybe, depending on which place you're in.
Turning.
Yeah, turning around. Maybe it is a disco ball, reflecting all these weird thoughts left and right. So there's these two dancing partners, right? Desire and aversion are really strong dancer partners. And so I'm starting to wonder, when doubt arises, and if we study our mind, we might notice doubt arises often. Does it ever arise by itself? Or is it always supported by desire, things to be other than how they are, or aversion, not wanting them to be the way they are, which are very closely connected? Or is doubt always arising in some relationship to the other pair of dancing partners in our ballroom? They must do a very strange dance, because they are restlessness and dullness, right? So it must be a funny thing, like, who's in the lead, you know? Probably restlessness wants to lead. Dullness doesn't want restlessness to lead, you know? So they have a lot of conflict, but they're dancing partners, so they can't get out of it. And so then I'm thinking, like, then I was reflecting on a class that I was teaching at the University of Washington. I'm in between classes right now. I'll teach this again in February. And this is a class in meditation and stress reduction at the medical school. And it's designed for medical students who have finished the coursework and are doing the long internship that they do, called residency and fellowship, which can be up to 6 years long, if you can believe that, unpaid internship. Yeah. And very intense and very busy. And they also they're also still studying and writing papers and responding to things in their work and stuff like that. And the other thing that's interesting about their residency is the main ones, I don't totally understand the system, but from what I understand, the people who are actually working in hospitals, you actually rotate hospitals about every month. And what happens on the Monday morning of your next rotation is you walk in the door, you say who you are, and you ask who your attending physician is, and that's your new boss. You may or may not have ever met this person, you know, and it's not like the whole hospital comes to a stop while they give you a nice little orientation and you get to know each other and have a little chat over a cup of tea. I don't think so. It's like, you know, gurneys are rolling by and, you know, the PA system is going and things are happening, right? So you have to really land on your feet. So these residents have a really tough thing, you know. And of course, they're also making literally life and death decisions pretty regularly, right? Diagnosing people, prescribing medications, making recommendations, deciding how to use their energy in this chaotic situation of hospital healthcare. And so the medical school got worried about these residents, you know, understandably, right? These people are stressed out. And it's been a very sort of a tough it out sort of system, a sort of 6-year hazing in some ways. So that made me think about where are we on? 1, 2, it's only 3, sorry, we're not getting very far. Our third mental factor, our third factor of awakening, diligence and energy. So these residents have to have a lot of diligence, right? A lot of energy. They have to stick to it. And the reason why they're starting to worry about residents and physicians, newer physicians especially, is that they're killing themselves. That's why they're worried about them. Yeah, so that kind of was the tipping point on paying more attention to how these systems work.
And suicides?
Yeah, suicide, yeah. They don't like to talk about it. I don't think it shows up in the New York Times, you know, but the numbers of physician and resident suicides are growing. Yeah, and we know from people who are working mental health in the universities that suicide among undergraduates is also growing and is also, you know, not so well publicized. So anyway, one of the administrators of the University of Washington Medical School, who was worried about this, was herself a very tightly strong, super capable, super smart person, as they all are. I mean, the system selects for that, right? These are very capable, quick thinking, you know, bright. These are our best and brightest in that sort of frame, you know, whether they really are, you know, there's a problem with that kind of judgment, right? But anyway, in that frame they are. And so the assistant dean of the medical school, herself a very sort of type A, intense person, was just working so hard in her job, working 60, 80 hours a week, and she had a bit of a breakdown. And in the course of having this little bit of a breakdown, she discovered yoga. She discovered yoga. And she became a very, very diligent yoga, like applying some of the same qualities to yoga. She became a very diligent yoga student, you know, practicing every day, going to multiple classes a week, still working 60 hours a week at work, you know, maybe 55, you know, instead of 60. And so somehow she heard about this system of teaching meditation and stress reduction. So she heard about my collaborator at the Veterans Administration Hospital, who is also a UW person, and she asked if they could have a stress reduction class. So he got me to teach it. So anyway, I've been teaching this class with the residents, and what's interesting about it for me is their attendance is terrible. Not so, no, not so, of course it is, right? Why would you think otherwise, you know? You would think these people who are doing this incredible thing for all the, you know, years and years, working so hard in these rotations, would suddenly realize, ah, you know, I can just relax, take charge of my time, go to mindfulness class every week, I'll feel so much better. So their attendance is not so good. So they fill the class every quarter, 20 people. You get 20 people signed up, and I show up on the first day, and there's probably 17 of them, you know, pretty good, a few don't show up, for the first week. And we do some meditation, we talk about stress reduction and all these things. And then the next week, there'll be about 8. You know, they just are busy, you know. It's hard for them to track adding anything to their life. The only time they could figure out that it would even be remotely possible for the medical school residents to add this to their lives is Sunday afternoon. So they're adding this on Sunday afternoon, which I think they're usually just collapsed on the couch, you know. So they got to drag themselves off of the couch, you know, and get into the, go to the conference room at the medical school to meet with me. And so in the first class that I taught, I really was feeling very discouraged about this. I'm like, well, where is everybody? We know this is going to help them. This is really critically important for them. The people who do come, you see really great benefit, right, you know, like pretty quick. They're a little disconnected from their bodies and their experience, as you would be, right? As a survival strategy, but right away you see them start to kind of unbend. And after, the people who stick with the class write to me later and tell me it really was a big life transforming thing, and they really appreciate it. But I noticed my mind, you know? I noticed on the surface a sort of concern for them in the abstract. Well, shouldn't they be here benefiting from this practice? And then I noticed under that was self-concern. I'm driving all the way here from Bellingham for 5 people. I am a fully ordained Zen priest. And I've received extensive training in this at great cost, you know, in Massachusetts. I had to fly to Massachusetts. I even flew to Massachusetts in the wintertime, you know. There was snow on the ground. It was like dangerous, you know. And where is everybody? And what I realized about that was the minute that I got engaged with that thought, I was not actually noticing these 5 wonderful people who were in this room with me, who had made this huge effort to get down to the conference room and practice mindfulness. So what is this mind, you know? This mind that wants something other than what we have, that doubts whatever it is we're setting out to do. So what is that mind? So I was realizing that all of this is really an important part of studying these factors of awakening. We tend to think about things in terms of adding something. If only I added another skill. Right? We think that way, right? If only I added another skill. If only I could figure out how to play my rhythms right. If only I could, be a better person, a kind of an adding. And in early Buddhism, they didn't think so much about adding. They thought more about dropping away and removing and sort of clearing off. And the term that they use that we now think of as sort of mental afflictions, all the problems, you know, greed and anger and desire and jealousy, you know, like the how many deadly sins are there? Seven? The seven deadly sins? So the term in Buddhism that they use for those is kleshas. And it turns out if you translate klesha really literally, it means something that's covering up your heart or covering up your mind. Sort of a thought covering or a mind covering. So we think about adding things, like if only we could add these seven factors, if only we had more mindfulness, more discernment, more diligence, more joy, you know, that'd be nice to have more joy, more lightness and ease, if only we had more concentration, if only we had more wisdom, then everything would be better. And if we have more of this stuff, we can kind of like overwhelm all those things we don't like, right? We can sort of like, you know, maybe doubt would just be sort of smushed out of my life, just like smushed out of my life if I had like a lot of good, solid mindfulness, discernment, diligence, joy, lightness, and ease, concentration, and wisdom. If I had all those things, if I really had all those things, you know, if I really studied this and I practiced hard, you know, maybe it would push all that away. And I think in early Buddhism, they didn't really think that way. I don't think the Buddha really thought about it that way. I think they thought about it more like, really study your doubt, you know, really notice desire. Feel it. Watch it arise. Watch it pass away. And when you are free from that and free in that and you're able to allow it not to grab hold of your mind, then naturally there's joy, right? Then naturally joy arises. And so when I was playing, we played two different songs last night in drum class. And one, we very carefully broke down each part and we're being very deliberate and we're trying to figure out each thing. And, you know, it was going okay. Keith had to stop us a bunch of times. We did that for about an hour and 10, 20 minutes. And then he whipped out this other rhythm, which maybe is an easier rhythm, I don't know, but he just said, okay, remember the parts, this part, let's just play! And we just played it, and we played it fast. And I couldn't really remember the part. I looked on the little sheet, and I was, you know, I don't know if I was doing exactly like the sheet, but I was doing a version of it, and I was just playing it. It was so wonderful, you know? There's so much joy there, just in the doing of it. Just in the doing of it. So this was actually what I was going to talk about. I was going to read to you about the traditional system of Zen training in Japan, but which is important too, because and maybe we'll do that another night. Because I'm still a little bit contemplating this mental factor of diligence and energy. The original, or I don't know about original, but the system of Zen training in Japan that somehow we've inherited something from. Like it seems that we wouldn't have Zen here, in this place, in this time, if people had not done the usual training in Japan. And yet we don't practice like them exactly either. So I have a nice autobiography. I'll read from you another time. By a Zen teacher named Soko Morinaga, and it's an autobiography about his training. He was born in the 30s, so he did most of his training immediately post-war in Japan. And it's very intense, you know. It's very intense. It's very diligent. It's very hard-working. And so maybe we'll contemplate some of his stories another night. Because this topic of doubt and how we need each other and whatever it is emerges from that feels so important, you know, and it feels like we can't wallpaper over this stuff. We can't wallpaper over this stuff anymore. We can't sort of just be nice to ourselves and others and just sort of smile even when we're actually not smiling inside. We need to notice, you know, that dance in the ballroom, which is a part of our life, and how can we ever be free of that and allow joy and allow wisdom and concentration to arise if we're somehow pretending that that's not going on. And we don't like that, you know. We don't like that message, right? We don't like being reminded of the darker side of life. We would like to be happy and not worry, right? That's a great song. Remember that song?
Don't. Be happy.
So I guess that's my talk for tonight. Thank you very much.
May our intentions equally impact.